non-rational man is basically an agnostic. He refuses to accept a transcendental law. However, he knows well that the norm legislated by him is of no value, is relative. Non-rational man is not destructive, he's not satanic, he's not diabolical. He's simply a fool. Rational man, logistic man, hates evil. He certainly does hate evil, even though he lacks the instrument to check it. Because there is one instrument to check evil. This is the transcendental law. By rejecting the transcendental law, man has lost the instrument with which he could check evil. Arrogant man is irrational because he is satanic, diabolical. He legislates norms, defines doctrines, formulates articles of faith, and ascribes to all those irrational things ultimate worth. There is something else. Irrational man may write, not only may write, he had written already a code of immorality. Immorality itself becomes a norm. Murder may turn into a noble deed within the frame of reference of irrationality. Nazi Germany is the best example. Many who killed Jews, who burned Jews in the crematoria, thought that they are actually accomplishing something, that they are conforming to a great moral norm and are implementing the moral law. While agnosticism is non-rational, metaphysical arrogance, which leads to idolatry, results is irrational because it is evil. And again, the Torah abhorred arrogant man. Who was the first arrogant man who wanted, so to say, to replace God, or to play God, or a late claim on ultimate validity of doctrine, law, and norm? This was, I don't know what he was, but he was quite clever and capable. This was our old friend, the serpent, Anocha Shakadmeni. Quite capable. And he told Eve, "Ki yedei alikim v'yimachochem emenu v'nifkechu emeichem v'yitzem kelekim yedetei vora." The job of man is to replace the Almighty. Nasir lo b'migdol v'reishi v'ashamayim. This is evil itself. And again, the Torah has forbidden arrogance, metaphysical arrogance. Where? While Adonai was forbidden by the 10th commandment, metaphysical arrogance was forbidden by the 1st commandment. Onechi ad Hashem lekecho liyoloch elohim acherim al ponai. And the incarnation, the personification of irrationality, of arrogance, which is evil, is who? Nochash has just said. But Nochash, if we had him around, we could settle our account with him, but he's not around. That's what we understand by the concept Amalek. That's at least what the Chachmei HaKabbalah or the Kabbalists have understood. Not a Bedouin tribe, not a race, but evil. Man Satan, who writes a code to kill and to oppress and to lie. That's symbolic. And here, something strange happens. The Torah has portrayed orgiastic man, an arrogant man, through two societies. The Deir Mabu, orgiastic man and arrogant man, and their societies, the aesthetic and the arrogant tyrannical society, by introducing two generations. As a rule, even though the Torah did it, and the Torah meant to do it in order to show the transition, as a rule, orgiastic society succumbs to tyrannical, arrogant society. I would even say, orgiastic society gradually, little by little, piecemeal, becomes, turns into a tyrannical, arrogant society. A pleasure-loving aesthete is ready prey to the intrigue, to the scheming of power-hungry satanic mind. He's too much involved, the orgiastic man, with himself. All his talents are consecrated to the goods. His imagination sees objects of his desire, nothing else. He doesn't see people, he has no historical sensitivity. Hedonic man lacks historical intuition. He cannot behold historical visions. He's too much involved in the present. He's too much absorbed in hedone. The non-rational orgiastic man lacks historical intuition, sensitivity to events. He doesn't feel the heartbeat of history. He's much absorbed in his hedonic experiences. You overemphasize foolishly the ideal of freedom that happened in 1917 in Russia. If Kerensky had had a little bit of intelligence, the whole communist revolution wouldn't have taken place. He overemphasizes the importance of freedom. He simply lacks the courage, the vision, and the power of anticipation. He lacks the predictive element in history. He does not experience history, since he lives just for the present. And little by little, his power is eroded, and he is replaced by the irrational man, who is time-conscious and future. That happened in Germany, and I was there so many years ago, in the late 20s, in the early 30s, an overindulgent, permissive, hedonic-drunk society. The society in our country now is tolerated, even promoted the rise to power of a tyrant, a madman. He was not, and the madman was not non-rational. Had he been that, he would have never lasted one day. He wouldn't have lasted one day. He was irrational, with a peculiar, demonic, diabolical logic, and weird thinking. He was dedicated to an absolute norm of his own making, the norm of immorality. And the same thing happens in the Western world, where the so-called youth movement, rejecting all norms, every semblance of regulated, self-limiting life, and and preaching boundless liberty, freedom freedom from all authority, are actually blazing the trail for irrational men to come and to take over. And the same happened in the time of Ahasuerus. What do we see when the curtain rises on the first act of Megillas Esther? What do we see? What do we see on the stage? What do we see? A feasting, pleasure-loving, and pleasure-pursuing society. The Book of Esther did not spare words in portraying vividly, with refined artistry and sarcasm, the repugnant addiction of the king, the princess, courtiers, and servants to lascivious pleasures, to the incessant pursuit of an ever fugitive satisfaction, the habits of an orgiastic society that was tired and exhausted because of satiety, and yet anticipated another satiety to be tried for the sheer novelty of it, is clearly portrayed. Why was it necessary to perpetuate the names of the eunuchs, the names of the harem keepers, Shashgas, Hegoi, the brands of cosmetics used by the king's concubines, the foul and lewd habits of the king himself, the scripture which is so tight-lipped about the lives of Moses and Abraham, became suddenly so loquacious in narrating the story of the king's wives, banquets, and the degenerate life at court? The answer is simple, because only in a such non-rational environment could irrational men Satan rise. Only people who were pleasure-pursuing had no fixity, no fixed norms, no ultimate validity, no doctrine. Everything was shifting like the sand dunes could tolerate a man Satan, irrational and destructive and cruel. Only people addicted to the beautiful and pleasant could stand by and watch the smoke rising from the crematoria chimneys climbing to heaven. Vayi b'mei Achashverosh. Do you know how this bloody nonsense happened? Because it was Achashverosh Shira, one of Edenei and freedom from the moral norm. Vayi achar advorim eile, in the society of Shashgas and Hegoi, must produce a Haman. It was true so many years ago, it is true today as well. Now, if you are not tired, nor bored, I would like to tell you what is the Jewish approach to the finiteness awareness. How do we handle that? We saw how modern man handles in two different ways. An arrogant way and an hedonic way. Of course, Yehadus, as I said before, objects to the two solutions which orgiastic and arrogant tyrannical men suggested. Yehadus asserts that the mamakim awareness can never be cast off. Never. Never. Woe is to the man who tries to shed off the mamakim awareness. Can never be cast off, suppressed, or changed by man. The latter must abandon those childish satisfactions, the hedonism and the big lies. Make, reconcile with the finiteness awareness and abolish all taints of spiritual gluttony. And Yehadus developed, in my opinion, four aspects of the finiteness awareness. There are four dimensions to the finiteness awareness. First of all, the metaphysical dimension. Man cannot and must not attempt to suspend the finiteness awareness, for the latter is interwoven into the texture of the I exist experience. Hence, man alone is unable to free himself from all the symptoms of that awareness, such as the feeling of loneliness, boredom, frustration, anguish, fear. Man is certainly incapable to defeat death. Salvation of man can come only from God. His companionship will heal man from the anxiety of being incomplete, finite, and transient. It is principle number one. Science will never solve the metaphysical problem of man. And all my respect to the psychiatrist, will never heal man from the finiteness awareness or from the experience of ma'amakim or minameitza kovasiko. Never! And don't listen to the beautiful, so to say, beautiful exposés and lectures delivered usually by non-scientists, by platitudinous people, about this prospect of psychiatry and the knowledge and the science of the mental processes of man, that they will solve the existential problem of man, never in their life. Because solve the metaphysics, I'm not speaking about psychiatric problems. I want you to know, insanity is a psychiatric problem. Metaphysics does not know insanity. But metaphysical problems of man who express themselves psychologically in a variety of manifestations, in a variety of aspects, can never be cured by man. Only salvation from God. Certainly not fear of death, nor death itself can be eliminated by man. I don't believe that medicine will at any time, 1,000 years from now, reach the stage at which it will be able to turn man into an immortal being. Of course, we believe in immortality, and we also believe that someday even psychosomatic man will be immortal. But only when it will be God's will to do so. Second, Yahadus believes that exploration of the entire universe, of the universe in its outskirts, in its fringes, exploration of the boundless stretches and gray uncharted plains of the astral world will never be completed. Yes, Yahadus has encouraged men to explore, to conquer, to rule. The latter may explore limited astral sectors, even the entire solar system, and if he want to believe and to dream, he may even make a trip. I don't know how long it will take, but according to what physicists say, in keeping with Einstein theory, if a young man will start out for a star in a different system, and he'll come back home, he'll be as young as he was on the day of departure. All right? The only question is whether he'll come back home. But however, yes. And I don't believe in it. I'll even say that we'll be able to get out of our galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy, and reach another galaxy. But this is just a small corner in the universe. The entire universe will remain an unknown mystery. The boundless uncharted lanes of the dark spaces and galaxies will remain closed to man. The reason for this is a simple one, because man is finite, and who knows what the universe is? And finite man cannot explore infinity and boundlessness. Number two. Now scientism, not scientism, but pseudoscientism, has become a religion for many, a cult. It's just as idolatrous as the cult of Stalin and Mao Zedong. And just as foolish. Third, man will never find the answer to the mysterium magnum question. How does the universe function? You'll never answer that question. Man has accomplished a great deal with his quantifying mathematical method. However, he just establishes abstract relationships, answering the how question from within, without answering the why question from without. And that will remain a secret. The mysterium magnum, mysterium tremendum, will never be resolved. Unless, and God will the eschatological age to commence. Fourth, men cannot and men must not legislate the moral norm. Men should be either ready to accept morality from God or give up any attempt to live a moral life. Because imposition of a secular code, secular finite relative code, upon society is in vain and is worthless. In my opinion, that's exactly what the original sin, the Chetah Kadmon, consisted of. Adam tried to do it, to impose, to legislate norms of good and bad, and brought disaster upon himself and mankind. Irrational man does it with arrogance, and he ends up with the law, with the moral law of immorality. Lahashmi lahare velave. So Judaism has accepted all four major aspects, and those four major aspects are four ma'amakim, the ma'amakim consciousness, as unalterable, God-willed, inevitable experiences of defeat. Judaism, it's very important, has spoken so beautifully of Tchilas Velovan. It's very strange that our tzitzis consist of two colors, Tchilas Velovan, white and blue. What kind of blue? The Rambam says, blue at noon, the color of the sky at noontime. Dazzling, light blue, dazzling, white blue. Rashi says, it is the color of the evening sky, dark blue, bordering on the black. And it's quite interesting that when the Mishnah asks the question, when is the one supposed to read Shema? So the answer is, Mishiyakir ben Tchilas Lelavan, when he is ready to discriminate, or he is able to discriminate, between blue and white. Discriminate where? So Tesis quotes a Yerushalmi, he should just pull out his tzitzis and try to discriminate between one or two threads of blue, or four threads of blue, and the white threads. What is the white color? The white color in Hebrew, in Hebrew language, in Hebrew semantics, is the symbol of plainness, simplicity, intelligibility, and familiarity, friendship. If you want to say it is clear, it is certain, it's undoubted, it is without, it is, there is no doubt about it, doubtless, you say Kashemesh Batzalayim. It's as the dazzling light coming upon us from the heavens. When the Raiva disagrees with the Rambam and rebukes him, he says, Lenoir, Letzoir, Leboyer. There is no light, there is no whiteness, it's dark. What does the Tchelis color represent in Yehadus? The Gemara asked, and the Gemara answered, Tchelis Deim Eliyam, the blue color is reminiscent of the large sea, of the immense vastness of the sea, Yam Deim Elorokia, the sea reflects the blueness of the sky, Verokia Deim Elekisya Koveit, and the sky, the heavens, reflect the glory of the celestial throne, of the transcendental Ribbono Shel Olam. Tchelis color, what did the Gemara want to express by it? The Tchelis color reflects distance, remoteness, beyond reach, the vast expanse of the sea, and the boundless astral distances. It reflects impenetrable mystery, enveloping the destiny of man. The tremor and fear, inspired by the incursion from time to time of the unknown, transcendent into our lives. And it happens quite often. Yehadus warned man not to be too sure of himself, not to be overconfident, not to be too cocky, if you want to say it, and not to be over-sophisticated, too clever. And Yehadus kept on telling us, and this runs like a red thread throughout our literature, from antiquity until to the Sifrei Musa of contemporary scholars. There are intelligible factors in reality which are flooded with the white, dazzling light. Everything in those sectors is clear, understandable, and intimate. In those sectors, one enjoys warmth and sweetness. However, there are also sectors enveloped in the dark blue of the mysterious evening sky, where man feels like a homeless wanderer who just happened to cross into a strange, foreboding territory. The transition from one sector, from the white sector, to another is quick and sudden. Tchelis of the evening sky replaces lovon of the bright day unexpectedly. How was it the night of the Yom Kippur? How was it 7 years ago? We don't try to invest to explore our own experiences. How was it? It was very simple. I was enjoying the bright day of my life, full of color and song. Three years had passed since I went through a serious abdominal operation, and God helped me to recover from that illness. There was, Baruch Hashem, no recurrence. It seemed to me as if everything was going to be simple, white, and magnificent, like the dazzling light of the noon sky, and that I'll be able to study Torah, mitoch osher, of course, with an aleph, not with an ayin. And the same evening, she told me, I have to enter the hospital for just observation. And suddenly the bright day, in a matter of minutes, turned into a dark, bleak, dreary autumnal night. Transition from Lovan to Trinus is a very quick and abrupt one. How was it in Shushan? Habiro. A day before, they feasted, Jew and Gentile, courtier and Ish Yehudi, together drank toast and hugged each other. And in a matter of hours, the pistols were sent out with the couriers, lehashmig, leharik, lehabeit, to destroy, to slay, and to kill. Yahadus says, I'm sorry, it's contrary to the American philosophy of pursuit of happiness. I'm sorry, I have to be an Epicurus as far as the Declaration of Independence is concerned. You'll excuse me, I mean, we have in our yeshiva people who watch for it, because watch out for it. I beg mercy, I should not be included among those at the crucifixion. Pursuit of happiness contradicts the finiteness awareness. And the finiteness awareness in Yahadus expresses itself in one word, man's insecurity vis-à-vis the future. Because man is a being who lives in time. He does not live in the present moment. The present moment is only a link. He lives in the past and he lives in the future. He remembers the past and anticipates the future. He feels nostalgia as far as the past is concerned. It's a devastating nostalgia. Many things he could have accomplished, and he didn't. I would give my right arm, to use a colloquialism, if I could just speak for 5 minutes with one of the 3 people I just lost 3 years ago. Just for 5 minutes. I tried to speak to them, standing at their graves. Today I stood at her grave. I addressed myself to her. There was no answer. Or perhaps the answer was lost, I don't know. I couldn't hear. This is the nostalgia for something that was within my reach, and I did not exploit the opportunity. I did not take advantage of it. I call this kind of nostalgia Merochei Kadeshem Nirvi. One begins to appreciate God when he is at a distance from him. Remote. When God is very close, orgiastic man doesn't appreciate it. Nostalgia is a part of the human mima makim, but then there is insecurity in the future. I tried to gain a glimpse in the future. Only fools can speak of security, unless they identify security with the stock market, and it's a very bad equation now. But what do you mean man's security? I always say, now I move my finger, my index finger. Whether I'll be able to move the finger 5 minutes from now, God knows, I don't know. And Chazal was considered every morning when man wakes up and stands on his feet as the day of Tchias Amesim, because unconscious man regained his consciousness. The miracle of Tchias Amesim in miniature, according to Chazal, happens and occurs every morning when sleeping man, unconscious man, wakes up and regains his awareness. I do exist, and my existence has a purpose, most probably. Man's insecurity, this is actually the word which expresses in toto the finiteness, awareness, the mina meitza korosiko, or mima makim korosiko adishem. And man's insecurity lies at the very root of prayer. Without the finiteness, awareness, without man's insecurity, there would be no prayer. The latter is the response to human misery stemming from the mima makim awareness. Let me just explain to you in short. Prayer, whether of biblical or rabbinic origin, doesn't matter now. We don't have to engage in the controversy between the Rambam and the Ramban, whether prayer is medraise or medrabana. But the chapter which Esther recited when she was about to enter the royal court. Only then is prayer meaningful when it dawns upon man, and mother man is too foolish, and he is not conscious of it, that his situation is a tragic one, that he is utterly defeated, that there is nobody to help him but God. Prayer and crisis are inexplicably linked up. Of course, the question rises immediately. If the crisis awareness is indispensable for prayer, how can prayer be recited daily? At times of peace and prosperity and success and victory, how can I say Rufeinu Ad Hashem Benerofei if I just this morning, came from the doctor, gave me his thorough checkup, and gave me what we call it in colloquial English, a clean bill of health? So what sense does the Rufeinu have? And what sense does the Baruch Aleinu, the same Baruch Aleinu Adomo, have if I have a fat bank account in the bank? Does it have a sense or doesn't it have a sense? Apparently it has a sense. What is the sense? In insecurity of man. Now I'm healthy. How I'll feel next morning, I don't know. There is future and present linked up. And this is the idea of prayer. And this lies at the root of the idea of prayer, the finiteness awareness of man. It is his nostalgia, devastating, completely unreal. He wants something which he can never get. He wants contact with the world which is gone long ago. He wants communication, communion with persons who are not here around anymore. They are far, far away. He wants many things because he was a fool. He missed them while they were around. He could just have, all he had to do is to stretch out his arm. He could reach them. He could have reached them. An insecurity of man. It's the second aspect of crisis, of the finiteness of awareness, of the mamakim umina meitzer. Now let me just finish. However, prayer in Yahadus, I want you to understand that, is not just a recital. It is more than that. It is a world outlook, and it is also a way of life. Because prayer, what is the term, the halachic term for prayer? Tefillah is all right, of course, but there's another term. The prime term for prayer, Aveda Shevalev. Aveda means, if you work, if you translate prayer into your daily life, into deeds. Of course, we said that prayer is the answer which Yehadus gives, or the response of Yehadus to the Mimamakim or Minameitzer awareness. The question is, yes, it is the answer to insecurity of man. When I am with God, I feel secure. And that's why, in my great agony and misery of a period, not 3 years, but almost seven years, I found companionship in the Torah. I've never learned as much as I did the last 7 years. Because I felt, while I studied, I've been studying, that someone behind me stands behind me, casting a furtive glance, leaning over my shoulder, and casting a furtive glance into the blood Gemara, and silently asking me, what are you studying? And that awareness of unseen presence has kept me, has guided me, has made me survive, physically, intellectually, and emotionally. Prayer is not enough. There must be a way of life which is prayerful, saturated with the idea of prayer, permeated with the philosophy of prayer and the metaphysics of prayer. What is the way of life which prayer reflects? Let me tell you that here. I'll finish. A prayerful life signifies first a consecrated life. Yehadus believes that each man, I mentioned it last year, but I'm developing it in a different fashion. Yehadus believed that each man has an assignment. A man is not born, is not cast, as the existentialists say, into this world in vain, for no purpose, for no reason. He is burdened with an assignment. Each man, in the opinion of Yehadus, is anointed, not appointed. Appointed, yes, but even anointed by the Almighty, to contribute something to redemption, toward the arrival of the eschatological age, to the great redemption. In other words, a drop of the holy oil, Shemen HaMishre, of consecration, fell on the head of every Jew. He is called to participate in the great march of generations who have been blazing the trail for the Melech HaMashiach since the dawn of our history. Each Jew is the herald, the harbinger of the Melech HaMashiach. All is a Melech HaMashiach in miniature. all by himself, because he blazes the trail for the great Melech HaMashiach. He drew as a messianic, eschatological assignment. And he Jew should think, I was born for one purpose only. This is the prayerful way of thinking, to serve. God has laid claim on me, has laid claim on me. Of the Melech HaMashiach. Oh, he is, I would say, a Melech HaMashiach in miniature, all by himself, because he blazes the trail for the great Melech HaMashiach. He drew as a messianic, eschatological assignment. And he Jew should think, I was born for one purpose only. This is the prayerful way of thinking, to serve. God has laid claim on me, has laid claim on me, or does lay claim on me. He wants me for his service. It's a plain pasuk in Israel. The old Jewish hymn, which has been echoing through the millennia and centuries, certainly says that man belongs to God. If entire creation is his property, so man, Allah has come over, come up. And if he belongs to God, so he is consecrated to the service of God. He is a Messiah in miniature. And when I speak of service, I mean two kinds of service. One service is the continuous one. Life itself is a service. HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If man knows how to live, if man knows how to plot his course, if a man knows how to respond to experiences, if man knows how to pray and how to treat his fellow man, this itself is a service. However, there is another service, a one-timely service, which in times of emergency, when a special urgent appeal addressed by God to man reaches him. Such an appeal, you know very well, was addressed, and perhaps my wife used to say, this is the gist of the entire Megillas Esther, was addressed to Esther. Such an appeal. It was just one timely, in a crisis, in an emergency situation, was an appeal addressed to Esther. Lovei lifnei ha-melech, el ha-melech ulevakish mufonav alamo. Such an appeal was addressed to Abraham, even though Abraham's life in its entirety was a service to God, was consecrated. But no one can get away from the one-timely appeal, which begins to echo through the uncharted spaces, separating us from the Almighty. Such a petition is submitted to each individual once in a life. The service which individual is called upon to perform is singular, which only he, the individual to whom the appeal was addressed, is capable of rendering. No one else can do the job which Dashkoche has assigned to him. The service requested of Esther was of a singular nature, and according to Mordechai's philosophy, Esther, who was born and made queen in order she should perform one service which took her just a couple of hours. ומי ידע אם לאיס כזאיס כדעת למלכוס, who knows whether thou art not come to the royal estate for such a time as this. I would just add two words, and who knows if you hadn't been born just for that purpose, and who knows if God hadn't bestowed beauty and charm upon you just for that purpose. The time has come. The call was sounded. Esther responded. This is one prayerful way of life. Of course, there's a second aspect to it. A messianic consecrated life, a life of service, is ipso facto a courageous life. It's a courageous life. What does a courageous life mean? I would rather use the term heroic life. It's a heroic life. And I have been saying it for a long time. If someone should ask me, what does Yahadus want of us? I would give him one answer. To live heroically. To live courageously. To live his fortitude. Heroic life, Yahadus disliked cowardice. Yahadus had contempt. I wouldn't say disliked, had contempt. For a mercantile logic. The logic of a businessman. I am not present company exclusive. There is some businessman in the audience. The businessman logic, the pragmatic utilitarian logic, which is too astute and too cautious, and which tells man that he must not begin unless he knows for sure that he is able to finish. Courageous life or heroic action is based fundamentally motivated not by pragmatic utilitarian mercantile discursive logical reasoning, because this reasoning is at best a coward, declarous, but is motivated, but is inspired rather by intuitive insights, by spiritual perceptions which are beyond the reach of the logical formal analysis. As a matter of fact, the most important decision, as a matter of fact, this is true of every man, Jew and non-Jew alike, the most important decisions in one's life are reached in the intuitive rather than in the logical dimension. The Jew of old, defying Haman, and the Jew of today, who has to do the same job, to defy not only one Haman, but the entire world, is not guided by syllogistic inferences. Because had he been very guided by those inferences, he would never dare to defy the world, to confront the world. Had he made an inquiry of the strictly practical, a bit pompous logos, he would have received an answer in the negative. From the logical, rational viewpoint, those relations, those rebellions, this defiance, this type of confrontation is plainly suicidal. Mordechai defiance of Haman was suicidal. Esther's risking her life and with it the lives of millions of Jews was logically unwarranted. She did because, as Chazal said, Bayim Ashlishi Vatilbash Esther Malchus, the Spirit of God has descended upon her. She was inspired. And in conclusion, a courageous life, a service life, dedicated to service, means a heroic life. A heroic life means sacrificial life. And the highest form of sacrifice for a human being is not to give his life. No. The highest form of sacrifice, the way Yehadus has understood it, is his readiness to leave the stage after he had played his part assigned to him and vanish in anonymity and oblivion. More than a person wants to live, a person wants to be remembered. Remembered by individuals, remembered by society, remembered that he has accomplished something. This quest for being remembered, for not being forgotten, is so powerful. I remember, I myself can reproduce instances many years ago when a poor woman used to bring me money in Boston. I should place her name on the memorial tablet in our yeshiva. And she used to count, used to charge $100 for my plaque. And she used to count the money, and her hands were trembling. And one quarter, and another quarter, and a third quarter, and a fourth quarter. And I used to ask her, "Tell me, my dear lady, how much savings do you have? What's my last savings?" It was the time of the Depression. "So why do you give the money to the yeshiva? You can't afford to do it." "Rebbe, ich will am Zomer nicht vergessen, I want to be remembered. Once I'll die, I know my children will never remember me. They'll never come to shul to say, Yisker. Perhaps the yeshiva will remember once in a while that I was an old woman." And this is not just the mentality of a primitive, unlettered, illiterate woman, but a very honest one, a sincere one. This is the mentality of Western man. When Johnson accepted the vice presidency offered by Kennedy, and it was a degrading acceptance, I would say a disgraceful acceptance, so one of the journalists asked him, "Why did you accept it? After all, as majority leader of the Senate, you have wielded so much power and influence, actually. The president was... You commanded the respect of the White House, and now as a vice president, you know what a vice president means in America. You'll just be an errand boy for the president." So he answered him, "Yes, yes. But history will give two more lines to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate. History will devote few more words to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate." Power at present means nothing. I'll be remembered. That's what Johnson said. And Johnson is not a metaphysician, nor a philosopher, nor a man of exceptional spiritual perceptions. Even though he acted like a man as far as Eretz Yisrael is concerned. But this is correct. And Yahadu's demands of man, anonymity. Let me give you an example. There are many boys who study Gemara here. But how many girls are here who study Gemara, I don't know. but boy is quite manumas. Tell me, you study Mishneh. Sta Mishneh. Or you study Mishneh and there is a controversy between individual and we call him the Tanekame. Who is the Tanekame? Who is it? So you ask me who the Tanekame? You answer me. You ask who the Tanekame is? This is the majority of Jewish scholars. What are their names? We don't know. Who is the Tanna Basra? We don't know. Tanna Rabbanu. Who are the Rabbanu? Who are they? Why was the Brais who were our records who were so stingy? So tight-lipped in enumerating the names? It is not just a coincidence. It is not laziness or neglect on the part of our Chazal. It's a method. It's a policy. The greatest of all sacrifices a Jew brings when he is ready to sink into oblivion and remain in the shadows of anonymity. The orgiastic society, as well as the tyrannical, arrogant society, attempt to overcome human finiteness, the mimamakim awareness, by substituting public memory for metaphysical immortality. Yehadus did not accept it. On the contrary, it considered the quest for having one's name recorded in history as sheer vanity. The individual, as such, can never become a historical figure. Only the covenantal community is perpetuated by history, has claim an historical immortality. The service which the individual gives to the community is recorded, but his private life is never recorded. The very moment the service is completed, history is not concerned with him anymore. The ideal cathartic experience is that of anonymity. How many facts did the Torah record pertaining to the lives of the patriarchs or Moses? Only those periods were recorded which were directly intertwined with the service they render to the covenantal community. There is never a complete biography. Only fragments have been selected, namely those which tell us about the sacrificial surrender of the individual to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those who echo the great word Afineni, which rings through endless spaces, I am ready and willing to serve. Nothing else but the Hineni was recorded. It's very strange. We know much more about Aristotle and Socrates and Plato than we know about the Vilna Gaon. I mean biographical data. Very little. What do I know about my father? Very little. He never talked about himself. He never wrote an autobiography. He never reminisced. I just know some episodes. What do I know about the life of my grandfather, Avraham Chaim? Just single episode. He never confided their private affairs, their private experiences, their clandestine emotions to anyone. Whatever happened, happened between them and God. It has never been made public. It's an aspect of anonymity. God requires of man the highest of all sacrifices, anonymity, which is genuine humility. He hates glamour, fame, external glitter, and certainly vainglory. He loves the actor or the actress who appears on the stage for a short while, plays his or her part humbly, and disappears immediately without receiving applause. Man stands in the limelight as long as he is the Messiah, the anointed who consecrated himself to the covenantal community. The very moment he finishes his job, the lights are dimmed, or rather extinguished, and he is out of sight. What does the Megillah tell us about Mordechai Yehudi and Esther Amalko? What did the Megillah tell us about Esther Amalko's life following the Haman episode? After all, she was a young girl when she was taken to the palace. She lived for many more years. I would like to know, did she remain the queen in Persia, or Ahasuerus sent her back to Mordechai and invited Shargash and Egoi to find another queen for him? It would have been quite curious to know about it. The Megillah doesn't mention one word. And the story is finished. And she has removed herself from the stage. What do we know about Mordechai Yehudi? What we know? Nothing. We know the Yesa Poroshas Duas Mordechai, Asher Gidle Amalech, Harlem Ksuvim Al Sefer Divrei Ayomim, L'Malchim Moda Yuforos. Go ahead and find them and read the story. Yes. One episode, and a very short one, of their lives was recorded. The rest is anonymous. And if somebody would, and that's exactly what Micha said, Hageid lecho Adam Ativ, Umad Hashem Derech Mimcho, Kimaseis Mishpot, Vehavas Chesed, Veatna Leches Imelekecho. It has been told thee, O man, what is God, what the Lord doth require of thee, only to do justly and to walk humbly. I would say rather anonymously. Who is thy God? Anyway, we must underline the word humbly. And this is our answer to Menachem Minametzer.